1-2-3. This is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University, and we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. Every week we talk about how to love ourselves, others, and higher nature. How to improve our life and our relationships, our finances, our health, and our happiness. We're at the Miami Book Festival this week, having a wonderful time with our fans and guests and a lot of great people. And we have a very distinguished guest today on the show, Richard Blanco, who is an American poet, public speaker, author, and civil engineer. He's the fifth poet to read at a United States presidential inauguration, having read the poem One Today for Barack Obama's second inauguration. He's the first immigrant, the first Latino, the first openly gay person to be the U.S. inaugural poet. He's been a professor, serves as education ambassador for the Academy of American Poets, and the airplane's coming, so I think you just arrived. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Now, this poem, One Today, that you did for the inauguration, what is the meaning of the poem? Tell us about that.
Well, you know, a lot of my body of work centers around my obsession about home, place, and identity. And so the poem came out of a genesis of still struggling with the question of what does it mean to be an American? Am I an American? Do I love America? Do I love this country?
Yes.
Does this country love me back? So the poem really is an answer to a very private question, but also thinking about what does the country mean to us? So if you look at the poem, it's sort of taking us through a sort of one day in the life of America and thinking about all the various lives and stories that make up who we are. It also inspired by our motto, which is out of the many, one, e pluribus unum. So that's, in a way, the poem is very public, and at the same time, it was something that was very very emotional for me as well. It was something that sort of a question that I still carry, an obsession that I still carry in my heart.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great honor to be. How were you chosen? Is this just by chance, or did you know people that got you in?
No, this is one of the most mysterious processes. You just get a phone call from the White House.
Okay.
There's no application process. You're not a finalist.
I see. Now, you wrote the poem before they chose you, or they chose you first?
No, they chose me first and asked me to write three poems.
Awesome.
So I had to write three poems in 3 weeks.
Oh, no. That's
kind of and they chose the one I read, obviously.
Wow, that's really wonderful. Are there any criteria they chose, as far as you know?
Surprisingly not. You know, I thought it was going to be much more, deep state kind of agenda. Not at all. Nothing.
Wow.
Other they just said what they just told me what the theme of the inauguration was.
Wow.
It was on Martin Luther King Day, which it got special permission to do that on that day.
That's incredible.
But really didn't edit anything, didn't give me any kind of agenda, not even a hint of anything.
Wow.
It was really purely creative.
What was your emotion? I know you said you met the president for 20 minutes or something like that. What was your feeling meeting him and also doing the poem?
Well, at that moment, again, even at that age, I was 44, I still wasn't sure that that I belong to the American narrative or that America.
You look young. You're only 44.
No, I was 44 back then. being in that moment and having the honor of being asked to speak and write a poem to the entire nation really finally made me feel like my story as a Cuban American gay kid growing up in the suburb of Miami, that's part of the American narrative. And the honor of also representing many people in a way, directly or indirectly, that also don't feel they're not quite that person on TV that's supposed to be the real American, right? So it was very emotional in that sense. I finally felt like I really do love this country and I really do belong to this country, and my narrative is not, it is the American narrative, right?
That's very interesting. Now, I think one of your books of poetry, you talk about being Cuban and a gay man in Cuban-American culture, looking for the Gulf Motel.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that, trying to understand how I fit between the two worlds, matron gay and Cuban gay. How's the difference in that?
Well, because for years I never really wrote about my sexuality and it wasn't sure how to wrap that story or how to approach that story. So I'm gay, so what? So are millions of people, right? And so it dawned on me that who I am, I can't separate the parts of myself. Like who I am as a gay man also has to do everything in terms of who I am as a Cuban, who I am as a poet, who I am as an engineer. And so this idea of cultural sexuality, that the story I wanted to tell was a unique story that Latino LGBT communities have to deal and negotiate different kinds of things that perhaps other cultures don't, and that is part of the story. So that really was my door, and it was started thinking a lot about my grandmother, who was my primary caretaker, and she was a woman who was as xenophobic as she was homophobic.
Cubans may not be open to that as much, like older Cubans.
So, right.
Were they angry at you? Were they surprised, or what was the whole thing?
No, I mean, what I learned in the writing process again was it wasn't so much that the sin, so to speak, or what was wrong, so to speak, according to my grandmother, was not the being gay, it was, as you know, in Latino cultures, when machismo,
oh, yeah,
it was the idea of being feminine or being effeminate.
Right.
And so my grandmother took it upon herself to, like, make me a man, like, or make me act like a man.
Yeah, macho.
Yeah, macho, right, okay. Right. So that was interesting, but also that crossed into over her xenophobia. So anything that was culturally odd to her was too Americano. Oh, she also thought of as gay. So oatmeal was gay, you know?
Well, you have some good stories to tell about that. Right?
Yeah.
Now, you also write, I think, about marriage equality as well, and you had something you wrote about that. Tell us about that part of it. Did you write a poem about that?
Ever since serving as inaugural poet, I've been asked to write different kinds of occasional poems, commission poems, and commemorative poems, and this was one case where Freedom to Marry, which was the organization that was largely responsible for the tipping point that happened with marriage equality, asked me to write a poem for their 10-year anniversary, which they then produced into a short film, which is widely available on YouTube. So it was a very interesting project. Obviously, it's something very personal because I'm of a generation where the idea of getting married was just not even conceivable when I was growing up.
And you were single at the time, but then you got married later?
No, I've been with my partner for 20 years. So,
but legally married, no?
No, not legally married. We couldn't.
Oh, now.
Not yet. But he proposed just a few weeks ago.
Okay.
I've been busy since the inauguration. We haven't had time to do anything.
Okay. You have cold feet, you think?
Yeah. I'm turning into a little bit of a bridezilla, though, yeah.
Now, the other thing is, you also wrote a memoir, The Prince of Los Cucuyos, A Miami Childhood.
Yes.
And I think you say, where am I from? Where do I belong? Who am I in this world? So you're asking certain questions. You say, from a young age, who are you? You talk about your grandma, I think, and the master and stuff. Monitoring your hobbies. No quilting, she said to you.
And what's that?
So you don't do any quilting?
No. You know, latch hook rug quilts, yeah.
And she bribed you to go on a date with the quinceañera or something.
Yeah.
Okay. So how did all that turn out in your life? Were they okay with your book, or did they get mad?
Well, I mean, that was, again, I'm now 51, so the memoir is from age 7 to 17. My grandmother has passed away several years ago, so that's my father, my grandfather. And so, I don't know. I think, in a way, it was a great process for me, and I think I got to, as I say in the dedication to the book, that writing that book allowed me to hate my grandmother, forgive her, and love her.
I see. Do you have mom or dad?
Excuse me?
You don't have a mom and dad around?
My mother is, yeah. But there's a language barrier. My mother doesn't read in English.
So. Okay.
I have a barrier. I have a built-in buffer because they don't, unless the book gets translated, exactly. They won't.
We had an author from Haiti, a very well-known female author, who wrote a memoir about her family in Haiti, talking about the domestic abuse and all this stuff. And she said that they really were angry at her for a while.
Yeah.
But she said it was her truth and she had to be authentic.
Yeah, yeah.
And that she owned the story of her life.
Yeah.
So that's what she had to work
This is Edwige Dundekar? No.
No, it's MJ.
Oh, okay.
That's another one. Yeah. But what do you think of that? Does that apply to you too?
I think it's, I'm not telling any really deep, dark secrets, but I always advise authors always have the students also have this question very much on their minds.
Yes.
I always say two things. One, you got to write it because what you think you're writing about, sometimes it's something else and you got to write through it.
Right.
And sometimes it's another truth that you didn't even know you could discover.
Right.
The other thing is that sometimes, there are these dark secrets that are the pink elephant in the room, and sometimes family and the community are actually appreciate that someone's finally pointing it out, right?
Yes.
And so there might be an initial phase of, met with rejection or whatnot, but at the end of the day, I think it's always a positive, a cleansing that happens. And again, the third thing I always say, just write it. You don't have to publish it, right? But you have to be true to yourself first. Or you can wait to publish it till you feel it's appropriate.
Right.
It's always a tough call, but I think it depends on each individual experience and what they're writing about.
Just kind of like a form of therapy. Do you feel it's a form of therapy? Like, people in psychology do journaling, where they write, deep feelings and thoughts. So it can be cathartic.
Very much.
Your feelings. Did you have the same experience?
Yes, very much. And even writing every single poem is somewhat of a cathartic experience. It's what keeps me addicted to writing and to writing poetry in particular, is because I always learn something new about myself, about my relationship to someone, about the world, about a current event. And it's that kind of deeper thinking that, I don't think poetry is therapy, but it is therapeutic in that sense, because it makes you not let life pass you by. You're pressing the pause button and you're investigating, you're digging into your life, you're questioning your existence.
Yes.
And And in that way, these amazing discoveries happen. And so, yeah, it's very much a kind of psychology. I love reading psychology books more than poetry books.
I'm going to agree with some of mine. This will be. Yeah. Well, I was thinking, like, you can answer my question, the power of poetry for the writer and the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying it helps you accept yourself. What are some of the benefits of reading or writing poetry?
I think there's a great saying by Anais Nin that says, writers live life twice.
Okay.
And I think that happens for us. We go back and go through the fine details, and there's that revelation.
Right.
And you come out a better human being, I think.
Right.
And I think that happens for the reader, too, because they're there on the journey. And even though you're telling a particular story, the emotions are all common. We all have the same basic set of emotions.
I thought that you were going to say, writers live forever. Which is kind of cool too, right?
You live in other people's hearts and souls.
Hopefully forever. You've heard of Jose Martí, the Cuban poet.
Yeah, of course.
People still reading him, right? And Pushkin, you know, some of the great poets.
Yeah, of course.
Now, in terms of advice for writers, do you have any advice for writers? So, like, what should they do? Because, you know, let's say they're stumbling blocks of writing, like a writer's block.
Yeah.
They don't feel they can do it. Or they get caught up in everyday life. There's too much going on. You know, they have families or their work are busy. So how do you make time for writing, and what's your advice for writing?
Yeah, sure. I guess it depends on what age and what genre you're writing, but I always tell, first of all, just dismiss the concept of writer's block, because that's really nothing. It doesn't really exist, right? Writer's block is part of the very process, right? It's like you have to stumble because, hey, if you just knew exactly how the poem was going to be, you know, then what's the point? Yeah. So it's just part of the process. Accept it. And also, even when you're in the middle of a poem, you might get blocked. The other thing, it's either that, or sometimes we're afraid of that. We're not really afraid of the writing, or we're just being lazy and don't want to write. Because it is in a way, you know, it's much nicer to go dancing or having a nice dinner. Writing is
hard work, right?
Is hard work. It's digging into yourself, and sometimes we're not ready for that.
Exactly.
So I would say that, you know, just accept that. Find time to write, but also it's not just the actual time, but just about living a life of a writer, thinking of the world as a writer, looking at through the lens of a writer, building community around writers, friends that are writers, making friends that are writers. You know, there's a lot of mystique around creative, around writing that, and I say, you know what, it's like every other human endeavor. You know what, you want to be a great football player, number one, you got to learn the rules, you got to learn the playbooks, you got to practice, get your butt out on the field, practice, you know, fail, get up. You might have a great game, a great season. Does that mean you're going to have a great game or a great season? Not if you don't keep on practicing. And so we get better at it. We find more time for it. We get more encouragement. We still fail, and that's part of the process. And it's always, like Maya Angelou said, every time you sit down to write a poem, it's like the first time. It's like every game is like the first time. If you don't have something at stake and you don't get the butterflies, you don't have anything.
Making love like the first time.
Yeah. I like that one.
Exactly.
No one gets bored of that.
Exactly. Well, somebody says, like, making love to the world, you know, when you write, right? Because you're putting your heart into it, your soul, right? Now, superheroes. Is there anyone in your life you consider a superhero, either, and, you know, it could be comic book, or it could be maybe history, or even today, a real-life person? Who do you really look up to?
I'm trying to think.
You're on the spot here.
I mean, honestly, like, my mother to me is my superhero. I mean, has always been, in a way, for so many reasons, but mostly she left Cuba 7 months pregnant with me, and with my older brother, 6.5 years old, to Madrid. I was born 45 days later. We emigrate again. And she left her entire family behind in Cuba, her 8 brothers and sisters, her parents, every aunt and uncle, every niece and nephew. And I've just always admired her for that kind of courage and that kind of faith in America and the American dream. So she's sort of a very close, I think I'm so much about my heroes tend to be my ancestors. I mean, outside of that, I think, just to give you a more sort of maybe expected answer, but Sandra Cisneros is one of my personal heroes and one of my good friends, luckily, because she gave me permission to tell my story, right?
Really? Now, have you met Nelson Diaz? He worked with Henry.
No.
Okay, he actually was under him.
No, I'm saying Sandra.
Henry. Okay, Henry's a different guy.
No, Henry's a. I think I've met Henry too. But
Now, what is Sandra? What is her? Is she a poet?
She's written poetry, but she's mostly known for her memoir. I mean, I'm sorry, for her fiction.
Okay, I've heard of her.
Short stories. Wow. She was like one of the first Latino writers when Latina was like a brand new thing.
Wow.
Like, so it was her, Julia Alvarez.
I see.
That kind of group, that Brat Pack that created.
So you have a group of mentorship with each other, no? Kind of a supportive group of writers.
Yeah, we share work. Even others, even from graduate school, that I still share work with. It's very important. That's another thing for young writers.
Yes.
You have to always share your work and get feedback. That's the only way you get better. It's like you always have a coach watching you watching you practice. Exactly. And he can give you tips, right?
Exactly.
So it's the same idea.
And Richard, one more important question. ¿Te gustan los tostones, arroz y frijoles?
Y sí, todo.
Eso sí.
Pastelito, croqueta.
There you go. Okay. I know you're Cuban, right?
Yeah.
All right, good. Now, where can people hear more about you? Do you have a website or other things?
Yeah, it's www.richard-blanco.com. That's a great place. There's all sorts of information on there. All I do, my events, also all the various books. At Instagram, at Poet Richard Blanco is Poet Richard Blanco. So that's always fun.
So.
And Facebook, of course.
Yes, well, it's great to have you on the show. You're a pleasure. We'd love to have you on again, Richard.
Great.
Thanks for coming
in. Thank you, Doctor.
So, Love University students, if you have any questions, you can email us at loveuniversitylove@gmail.com, 310-226-8090. Visit us at loveuniversity.love. Like us on Facebook at Love University Podcast. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @LoveUPodcast. Until next time, Love University students, put away your notepads, your books, your iPads, and this is Dr. Alex Avila.